Good morning, this is Hugh LaFalla, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Cass Sunstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago, and we're discussing his book, Risk and Reason, Safety, Law, and the Environment. Cass, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
I wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a sort of brief summary of the argument in Risk and Reason.
The basic idea is that none of us deals quite as well with risks as we might if we were perfectly informed and able to respond to them, to risks on the basis of the information that we have. So we tend often to fear things where the risk is low and not to fear things when the risk is high. And this can shorten our lives or make us sick or something else. A pretty vivid recent example was the sniper attacks in Washington, D.C., where people were extremely frightened of getting hit by the sniper. And it was a very understandable fear, hard to avoid it. But the statistical risk was actually tiny. And people in ordinary life are willing to face statistical risks that are as large as the sniper risk or a lot higher without worrying a bit. So the basic idea is that individuals often run risks they shouldn't and don't run risks they should, and that our legal system and our government are responsive to what we want. So we often end up getting the government regulating risks that are pretty small, and the regulation can cost a lot of money, which is bad if it leads to unemployment at higher prices. And sometimes the government, because regular people aren't worried, the government isn't worried either. So in contexts like indoor air pollution and, until recently, cigarette smoking, the government does relatively little, even though thousands or hundreds or even hundreds of thousands of people are at risk. So the basic idea is that individuals just aren't equipped by evolution to think about risks in the way that would be ideal, and government follows people, and that can lead us into big trouble.
Well, let's talk about that idea a little bit more, and then later on in the show we'll look at some of your proposals about how to deal with this problem. But as you take it there, the average person has trouble judging risks, that we tend to misjudge both ways, and that the consequences of misjudging can be pretty dramatic. I wonder if you'd maybe give talk about that in general and maybe give some specifics. I mean, you mentioned indoor pollution as potentially an example of something which we don't fear and perhaps ought to.
Yeah, well, indoor pollution is something that people don't think about very much. It's not like, you know, tons of people are dying, but a lot of significant health problems come from indoor air pollution. Whereas the risks associated with abandoned hazardous waste dumps, which people are very worried about, are actually, those risks are mostly very low. So we can explain this a little bit by just thinking about what makes people concerned. And the Nobel Prize in economics was just given actually a few weeks ago for some analysis that's tried to figure out when people think something's going to happen. That was part of what the Nobel Prize was given to someone for discovering. And what human beings tend to do in trying to figure out whether something's going to happen is they think of an example. Can you think of an example that comes to mind? So we get people in the United States who are very worried about the risks associated with unsafe sex because they know examples where people have actually gotten HIV or died from HIV. And there are other parts of the United States where people aren't really worried about unsafe sex at all because they don't know anybody who's had HIV or who's gotten sick as a result. Indoor air pollution doesn't have vivid examples of harms associated with it. It's very difficult to think of anyone who has gotten sick as a result of indoor air pollution. Or if you do, you might be able to think of coughing or respiratory problems. But that just doesn't have a salient example in it. And if you compare hazardous waste dumps, well, the Love Canal problem in New York got tremendous attention in the 1980s. And a lot of people were focused on that as just an example of how an abandoned hazardous waste dump could cause high levels of cancer. So if there are salient examples that come to mind, people tend to think a risk is probable. If an example doesn't come to mind, they tend to think it's improbable. And that governs individual behavior. It also governs our law so that we have a lot of aggressive regulation, sometimes in cases where there are vivid examples, and we don't have much regulation in cases where there aren't vivid examples. So that's the tendency that both individuals and governments get into.
And the vivid examples don't have to be someone we know. It can often be as effective to simply hear about it in the press. So the media itself can be very important in promulgating certain misconceptions about risk.
Yeah, the media can produce situations of both hysteria and neglect. Like, there was a lot of attention in the last months to the problem of abduction of girls. And the previous summer, there was a lot of attention in the media to the summer of the shark, where there were apparently a lot of shark attacks. And so these are not things that people have personal experience with, but if there's a lot of media attention to abduction of girls or shark attacks, then people can be really worried about these things. And in fact, people all over the United States were worried summer ago about shark attacks, even though there was no increase statistically in the number of shark attacks, and even though the risk of a shark attack was very, very tiny. There's no evidence that the problem of abduction of girls is higher now than it's been, but many Americans have actually been really worried that this is a serious risk that their children face. It's not something you shouldn't think about at all. I mean, it's good to be cautious, but with respect to abduction of kids, it's basically not a statistically significant problem facing America. So what the media tends to can activate hysteria, make people much more worried than they need to be, and what the media doesn't attend to can lead to a situation of neglect.
Okay, well, another thing you talk about in your book is not so much matters about particular things which people fear or don't fear, but sort of general principles or beliefs which many people tend to have about risk, beliefs that tend to shape their reactions. There are a couple I thought that were particularly important, that many people tend to assume that risk is all or nothing, that something's either safe or it's risky, that they don't think about it as a matter of degree of safety being safe or a degree of being risky. And the second thing that people tend to think that the natural is always safer than the man-made. What if you could say something about each of those?
Yeah, it is true, you know, that both adults and children tend to think about a situation, is it safe or is it dangerous, as if they're two, you know, sharply divided categories. And one thing that terrorists try to do is to move people's minds from the safe category to the unsafe category. So after the sniper's attacks, people thought, and the snipers actually said, you can't be safe anywhere, or your children can't be safe anywhere. And after the September 11th attack, a lot of Americans asked, can we be safe anywhere? Which seems to be how the human mind is kind of wired. But the truth of the matter is that there's no situation that is 100% safe. And there are few situations, thank goodness, that are, you know, 100% unsafe. At least those are not normal situations. They're extremely abnormal. So we're just on a continuum of safety. And when something bad seems to be in the offing, like there's an increase, let's say, in assaults in your neighborhood, chances are that there's been a modest statistical increase from maybe you had a 1 in a million chance of getting assaulted, and now you have a 1 in 100,000 chance of getting assaulted. So we're just talking about degrees of safety. You could see this in the context of the recent national debate about arsenic in drinking water, where President Clinton wanted to cut the amount down from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion, and President Bush was nervous about that. He eventually went along with the Clinton suggestion, but didn't at first want to. What the debate was about really is what degree of safety will we have in our drinking water, not is it going to be safe or not. With 50 parts per billion, it's a little less safe than with 10 parts per billion, but it's not a huge difference, and we're on a continuum of risk. So that's just how life is almost all the time, but it's not how governments and human beings always think. With respect to the natural and the man-made, it is true that human beings tend to think, and polls really show this powerfully, that man-made chemicals and such are more dangerous than the products of nature. And that's a very widely held thought. But in terms of risks, it's just not true. A lot of the worst risks that we face are from nature. Arsenic is made by nature. Many poisons come from nature. Earthquakes and floods and heat waves come from nature. So nature is a product of many of the worst hazards that we face. And man-made risks, like the risks associated with chemicals and pesticides, are often trivially small compared to the natural risks. It's not, it would be exaggeration to say that what comes from man-made sources is safer than what comes from nature. We have to look at the specifics. But people tend to be quite concerned about herbicides and pesticides and much less concerned about natural products. But this is just a mistake. Nature is far from always benign, and humanly made good synthetic chemicals and such, synthetic pesticides, are often the source of low risk, relative safety. So we ought not to think that nature is preferable to man-made if what we want to do is have longer and healthier lives.
Okay, so both individually and collectively, we tend to make misjudgments about risk. And the solution to this, or at least an important part of the solution in your view, is to adopt a cost-benefit analysis. In a way, you've already talked a little bit about that. You're saying that we ought to recognize that risk is not a matter of all or nothing, it's a matter of degree. And so one of the things we need to do is to identify the degree to which something is safe or risky. And then we also need to look at the cost as well. Could you say more about what precisely this cost-benefit analysis would look like and why you see it as helping solve this problem, or at least lessening the problem?
Yeah, I can talk about it in connection with the arsenic regulation, which was one where the government actually analyzed the costs and benefits pretty carefully. You might think one question with arsenic regulation is just what's the expense? And the reason we care about the expense is that if your drinking water bills go up, that's going to make it harder to pay for other things. And for people who are poor, especially in poor communities, significant increase in water bills are a real problem. So the government tried to analyze that. It turns out the cost of the Clinton arsenic proposal would be about $200 million a year, which is not trivial, but it's certainly not an extraordinary expenditure if you're going to get some gain from it. What they also tried to do was figure out, of that $200 million, who's going to be spending a lot every year on their water bills and who's going to be spending a little. And it turns out that people in rural communities where just a few people are served by a water source would pay a lot, up to $300 a year more, and people in big cities where tons of people are being served by a water source would pay not so much, maybe $20 more a year. So what the Clinton administration saw was that we have a $200 million price tag where some people are being paid having to pay a fair bit, some other people aren't paying much. So that's on the cost side. Now, on the benefit side, what they wanted to try to figure out is, are we making people significantly healthier? And they actually have a lot of information about arsenic risks, and they tried to use that information to project what the savings would be. And so what they figured out was we'd save somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 lives a year as a result of cutting the maximum level from 50 parts per billion down to 10 parts per billion. Something like 25 lives per year would be saved. And they also figured out you'd reduce some bad health effects short of death, too, cancers that are curable, like skin cancer and others. So what they tried to do was to just quantify the projected life savings as well as the projected cost savings. Now, to make the analysis complete, you have to turn the health and mortality savings into dollar equivalents. And there are a lot of people, including me, get nervous. And the reason we get nervous is we don't think that a human life really is the same as $5 million or $6 million or $7 million. These are just qualitatively different things. Nonetheless, government probably has to figure out some way to know whether it's going to go forward with a regulation when you're going to save a large number of lives or a small number of lives. So what the Environmental Protection Agency did, and this is pretty standard, is to use a number, roughly around $6 million per statistical life saved. And that number comes from some studies, a wide variety of studies, that try to figure out how much individuals are willing to pay to reduce low levels of risk. So they're trying basically to map onto actual human behavior. And once they ran the numbers, it was pretty simple arithmetic, they concluded it's worth it to go down from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. It's worth it because the $200 million is compensated for by the savings. Now, it might seem like a kind of science fiction exercise, this kind of simple arithmetic, but what I really like about it is it enables us to make choices that aren't just stabs in the dark or guesses or hysteria or neglect, but enables us to compare the good things we're getting from regulation against the bad things that regulation is causing. And this is a way of informing decision makers about what to do. Interestingly, the Bush administration went along with the Clinton administration partly because when it ran its own numbers, it saw that the risks associated with arsenic are not zero. They're not huge. This isn't like tobacco smoking, but they're real. And the costs of the arsenic regulation aren't huge. So the Bush administration ended up thinking that on the numbers, the Clinton administration was right. Just kind of a testimony to the power of, you know, trying to get the science, get settled on the science, the power of that to overcome political disagreements.
Okay, I want to continue discussing that in the second part of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Cass Sunstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago, and we're discussing his book, Risk and Reason. Someone hearing the last discussion, though, might draw an inference, which I take them that you wouldn't want the person to draw. The inference that someone might draw is that when you do a cost-benefit analysis, you simply come up with a single figure for the cost and a single figure for the benefits. You can easily then determine the trade-off. There's no judgments, no disagreements at all when it comes to cost-benefit analysis. And I take it you think that's not the right way to think about cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, I really don't. Some people who are kind of almost like theologians about cost-benefit analysis think that it's a magic bullet which will solve our problems, or a pill that will cure what ails us. And I don't think that. I think that's an overstatement, because there are two things that leave room for uncertainty or values. One is sometimes we just won't know exactly what we're going to get from a regulation. In fact, often we won't know what we're going to get from a regulation. And arsenic, where we had a fair bit of information, all that could be done was to specify a range. So I said 25 lives or so will be saved annually. The Environmental Protection Agency actually gave a range that was fairly spread, roughly from about 22 to 45, something like that. So, you know, there's uncertainty just in the science from which we're extrapolating. And when we make the extrapolation from other countries or other animals to thinking what's going to happen for us, there are going to be some scientific disputes, and there are also going to be disputes of value. Should we build in a kind of conservative assumption to give the benefit to health, or would conservative assumptions end up giving us really falsely large savings? Those are the kinds of disputes that come up in trying to quantify the numbers of savings we're going to get. So at the first level, there's often uncertainty about what the health savings are. But there's another uncertainty, which is how to transform the health savings into dollar equivalents. A lot of people are nervous about doing that at all. I think we should do it, just as a way of giving us a tool for making sensible decisions. But once we've decided we should do it, we could have high value for statistical lives or low value for statistical lives. And, you know, some people in the Bush administration think the number should be under $6 million, which is what the EPA is using. Some people in the Bush administration think it should be higher. And there's no purely scientific way to make that assessment. What I think is nice about cost-benefit analysis is even the disagreement between the lower and higher often will just result in ranges. you know, we can have a lower bound and an upper bound, and that will at least help us know what we're doing when we're deciding how much to regulate arsenic.
Okay, so despite the fact that it's a matter of ranges, despite the fact that there are value judgments involved that can't be at least easily boiled down to numbers, nonetheless, it's a valuable tool because it at least eliminates some possible answers to the question about whether we should or shouldn't regulate an object.
Yeah, and it also helps us get past a political debate, which has been unhelpful to the United States for the last 30 years and which is continuing. The political debate takes the following form. A lot of people say, you know, we should rely on markets, government regulation is bad, and we should just basically free up people from government's heavy hand. And that's one side. And then the other side says, you know, people are facing real risks in the workplace and in the environment, and we can do whatever we can or whatever is feasible to protect them. And basically, Democrats have often been saying the second, and Republicans have often been saying the first. Neither position is really helpful. The reason the Republicans have a strong point is if regulation costs a lot of money, imposing it is going to create real human harms, not harms just for companies. If a company has to spend many millions of dollars to reduce levels of benzene, let's say, in the workforce, that is highly likely to mean that some workers are going to lose their jobs or that consumers are going to pay higher prices. And if consumers are paying higher prices, the people who are going to be hurt most are poor people who can least afford the extra expense. So we need to know about the cost side. Where the Democrats have a point is that often the risks that workers face or that consumers face are serious ones, and sometimes people lack the information that would enable them to reduce that risk. And so if you can't provide them with information, then what you probably should do is figure out the size of the risk. If the risk's low and it's going to cost a lot to get rid of it, chances are shouldn't do anything about it. If the risk is really high and you can do it relatively low cost, then by all means do it. So I can get to specifics on this if you want, but some of the most aggressive regulations we've seen in the United States have been driven by cost-benefit analysis, which has shown that we can get a lot of human health protection without hurting the economy much. And so this gets by a kind of rhetorical game in which Republicans and Democrats both appeal to their constituents' least helpful goals.
Okay, let's look at some of the specific proposals that you have in mind that might utilize the cost-benefit analysis. We've got about 6 minutes here, and in your book you divide them into certain things that government could directly do, both the legislature, the administrative branch of government, and perhaps even the judiciary, and then later you talk about smart tools as a way of dealing with the problem. Maybe we could just, if you could say a little bit about what government could do or should do, and then we can look at some of these smart tools as a way of protecting people from very high risks.
Yeah, I think the White House should require the agencies that are supposed to protect us to produce a detailed assessment, to the extent that they can, of the consequences for Americans of one or another course of action before the government agency chooses a course of action. So if the government is deciding how to regulate some pollutant, say, before embarking on regulation, it should try to assess the expense of the regulation, and if it can, it should try to figure out who's going to bear that expense, and it should try to assess the benefits of the regulation, and if it can, it should try to describe who's going to get those benefits. And it should try at the same time to compare the costs against the benefits to see which is higher, not thinking that it has some sort of mathematical solution, but that it has a really good ingredient in the decision. And every time the government does something that's very expensive or refuses to do something that might be very protective, it should have to engage in that analysis. Now, that might seem like an exotic and even weird idea, but it's been the requirement that President Clinton, both President Bush's and President Reagan have all imposed on agencies. It's just that agencies aren't living up to it. So America's a young country, and this aspect of our country is extremely young and just being developed. I also think that Congress, before it enacts a law governing regulation, or before it doesn't do that, should, if it can, sometimes there's just too much uncertainty, should try to get a very concrete sense of the consequences we'll face from one or another course of action. That way we could get much less loud fights between people who disagree and much more concentration on whether we're really going in a direction that's good for the public.
Okay, in the last 3 minutes, could you discuss some of these smart tools, which you see as potentially very effective ways of protecting people from risk without much cost?
Yeah, I think this is some of the most exciting material in American government in the last 30 years. One thing you can just see if you have if you've gotten food recently is this nutrition facts on food, which the government requires. And this doesn't impose any regulation. It's basically just trying to inform consumers so that they know before they buy food what's in it. And this is a regulation which is having a very good impact in getting people to choose things that are healthier for them. That isn't to say that people always make the right choices, but they are making better choices now because they have the information. The deal is even better than that, which is that the fact that companies have to put nutrition facts on what they're selling imposes pressure on them to have healthier rather than less healthy foods. And I have a hunch, which is that the amazing outpouring of healthy choice type foods, lean cuisine, and so forth, is in part a product of this Nutrition Facts initiative, which the government embarked on. So that's great. Another one that the government has done, which has been probably the most successful environmental program of all, is in the 1980s requiring companies to disclose their toxic emissions, just to disclose them. And this was to inform government about toxic emissions so government could maybe eventually regulate them. Well, what's happened is the disclosure requirement by itself has been a terrific regulatory mechanism because companies don't like to be found out to be the big toxic polluters in the last year. And companies that would otherwise be on the list of the Dirty Dozen or the top 10 toxic polluters are so nervous about that designation that they've reduced their toxic pollutants very significantly. So we have a steady and dramatic decrease in the United States in toxic pollutants without the government imposing a penny's worth of regulation. That kind of information disclosure is really a wave of the future.
Okay. In the last minute, if you were going to make a suggestion both to the average listener and perhaps to lawmakers about what we could do, what would that suggestion be?
Well, for the average listener, I guess I'd say that when a risk is very salient, in the sense that, you know, there's been a lot of attention paid to it in the last month, it's good to know that the risk might actually be really small, but just eye-catching. So in ordinary behavior, to avoid a kind of paranoia that can come from short-term fears, and also to follow, to the extent possible, scientifically responsible work about what's really risky. So if people have good diet and good exercise and don't smoke or drink in excess, they're doing much, much better for their own health than the various things that catch the public's attention, like snipers and anthrax. For government, I guess I'd say basically the same thing, which is to be very careful about responding to short-term public fears that are easy to activate, even if the facts aren't there, and also to be very careful about neglecting situations in which the public isn't afraid, where the risks are real. In the context of airport security, the experts had said we're vulnerable for years, but the public didn't have an incident for about a decade, and that's one reason why our airports weren't safe until recently.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking today with Cass Sunstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago. We've been discussing his book, Risk and Reason. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.